Best things in California, Daedra.
Danny.
So first he's going to lead us through calm abiding and then directly into insight meditation. And he starts actually with the posture. Does he? Maybe he doesn't. Oh, he does. Okay, so I'll begin. So let's just check in sort of quickly with our posture, just sort of get ourselves into meditative mode, within which ultimately we'll do non-meditation, but we, at the beginning, we need the posture and we need our mind to be sort of just aware, like allowing our mind to begin to settle. So he begins with a little explanation. He says, methods for attaining sustained calm or shamatha fall into two main groups, those in which an object of focus or concentration is used and those in which there is no object. Here I will explain the first method, using as the object of focus a visualization of Lord Buddha, which brings more blessings than some ordinary object. So here we begin the meditation. Sit in the perfect seven-point posture of the Buddha Vairochana, your legs crossed in Vajra posture, or in the chair we will, you know, feet on the floor, feet parallel, but on the floor, very grounded. Your two hands resting in the mudra of equanimity, or whatever mudra you are used to or prefer for meditation. Your shoulders raised up. I take that as more just sort of a squaring and stabilizing of the shoulders. Your vertebral column straight like a pile of gold coins. Your chin slightly tucked in. Your eyes steadily focused in the space in front of your nose. And he says steadily focused here. Generally, we let our eyes be unfocused for meditation because we're not zooming in on something. So, but steadily resting, I would say, maybe in the space in front of your nose. And the tip of your tongue touching your palate. This is an instruction that's sometimes given. It's often given, and it's given in the appendix, which we'll talk about later. But it's optional. If it's not comfortable for you, you don't have to do that. And it apparently helps with this energies in the body circulating a certain way that's very conducive to the mind coming to rest. If you find this posture difficult to maintain, at least sit upright and well balanced on a suitable cushion. Avoid leaning backward or to one side or taking any other lax posture. So within that posture, allow your mind to settle naturally. So let's take a moment to just let our mind settle naturally. If you want to follow a few breaths, you can, or just let your awareness expand into open awareness, or use a sensory object. Whatever you prefer to bring your mind to a more restful state. And again, restful doesn't mean that no thoughts are arising. It just means that we're not caught up in them. Now visualize Buddha Shakyamuni in the sky in front of you. Doesn't matter if it's a perfectly, you know, detailed and accurate visualization, just however you visualize the Buddha. And he's going to give us a little help in visualization in the guided meditation. So Buddha Shakyamuni is in the sky in front. He is seated upon a moon disc, which is on a lotus that rests in turn on a throne supported by eight fearless lions. And one thing that I asked Lamanarla Rinpoche a long time ago, actually when I was in retreat, because we did some very complex visualizations in retreat, as each detail is mentioned in the text, you visualize that, but you don't have to hold on to the whole thing, which can be like cause you mental strain. If you want to hold on to it all, if you keep the moon and the lotus and the eight lions and then everything else adds on to that, that's fine. But you can just sort of bring each detail into, you know, into awareness one by one, and then don't worry about it, but you'll have a full picture of the Buddha. His body has all the radiance of gold. With his right hand, he touches the ground near his right knee in the gesture of taking the earth as witness, or we sometimes call it touching the earth. While his left hand, in the gesture of equanimity, that's like as if it were holding something, resting in the lap, he holds in his lap a begging bowl filled with nectar. He is sitting cross-legged, wearing the three Dharma robes. Just whatever, don't worry about three, but just whatever robes you see him in. His body is graced with all the 32 major and minor marks of a Buddha, notably the Ushnisha on the top of his head, the protuberance on the top of his head on the crown, wheel patterns or Dharma chakras, that's the Sanskrit for wheel patterns, on the palms of his hands and soles of his feet, and a long hair between his eyebrows curling counterclockwise like a white conch. So that's the protuberance on the top of his head, wheels on the palms of his hands and the soles of his feet, a long hair between his eyebrows curling counterclockwise like a white conch, and any of the other signs and marks that you may remember. From his body emanate infinite light rays of wisdom, which fill the whole universe. And these are sometimes described as multicolored, like the five wisdom colors. He is directly in front of you in the sky, gazing straight at you with compassion. Visualize the Buddha as living, not inert like a statue made of clay or bronze or like a two-dimensional drawing, but as a full three-dimensional human being who is alive in front of us, looking at us with compassion. The colors and details of his form are perfectly clear and vivid, yet he is insubstantial and transparent like a rainbow. He is not made of flesh and bones, but appears as the empty but radiant unborn wisdom of the Buddhas, full of compassion and wisdom. Try to focus one pointedly on the visualization, meaning not getting caught up in any kinds of distractions to do with sensory perceptions or thoughts coming up. Seeing all the details as clearly as possible. Again, you don't have to hold all the details in your mind at the same time. One of the ways that we meditate on the form of the Buddha is that we can shift. We can shift our focus to different details throughout the meditation. But Dingo Chenzin Rinpoche says we should see all the details as clearly as possible. Have total confidence that the Buddha is actually there in the sky in front of you, remembering that for those with faith, the Buddha is always present. And the Buddha himself said that. If we visualize him and think he is present, then he actually is present. So now we are in the presence of the Buddha, simply letting our minds rest in the visualization of how the Buddha looks, his radiance, the compassion with which he's looking at us, and so forth. As you rest in this visualization, the Buddha, all your wandering thoughts will eventually subside. To keep your mind focused in this way on a clear and steady visualization is shamatha or shine or calm abiding, sustained calm. So we're going to rest like that for a minute or two. And as always with meditation, our mind may tend to wander off. That's not a problem. As soon as we notice it, we just bring it back to the Buddha. So Dinka Rinpoche now gives us a couple of remedies for like ways in which our meditation can be a little unbalanced. And I'm going to read through those. And you can apply, just try applying them, whether you have the particular imbalance or not. To make your focus more and more stable, you will need to counteract different disturbances of the meditation as they arise. If your mind grows wild and your thoughts begin to race, preventing you from achieving a clear visualization, look slightly downward in the space in front of your nose, just lower your gaze, and focus on the lower parts of the visualization, the crossed legs of the Buddha, the lion throne, and the lotus seat. This helps to reduce wildness. So we'll do that. We'll lower our gaze and look at the lower parts of the visualization. If, on the other hand, your mind sinks into a state of drowsiness, slackness, or dull indifference, or you get sleepy, why that's drowsiness, I said that, raise your gaze higher into the space in front of you and concentrate or focus on the upper parts of the visualization, the perfect oval of the Buddha's face, his eyes, the hair between his brows. This clears away the sinking feeling of dullness and slackness. So now we're going to try raising our gaze and focusing on the upper parts, the Buddha's face and head and features. When your mind is balanced, neither wild nor dull, focus straight ahead on the Buddha's heart, in which rests the eternal knot of the secret treasure of pristine wisdom. So if you know what an endless knot looks like, you can focus on that. And otherwise, you might want to look it up sometime. But you just look straight ahead at the Buddha, like just taking it all in, if your mind is neither distracted nor sleepy. Focus on being aware of the presence of the Buddha in front of you, confident that he is actually there. Visualize the perfect mandala of his face, his two eyes gazing with compassionate wisdom upon all beings, his perfectly proportioned nose and ears, his smile, the boundless rays of light emanating from him, and gradually extend the visualization to all the details of both the upper and the lower parts of his body. This will make the whole visualization more vivid. So now, to whatever extent our mind is resting in the visualization of the Buddha without distraction, we are now in a state of calm abiding, sort of the stillness aspect of the mind. And we're going to move into how to use this visualization for insight or lakdong meditation or vipassana. When your visualization is clear and your mind is still and quiet, permeate the state of sustained calm with profound insight. First, consider who or what it is that is perceiving the visualization. So Ken McLeod has led us through that kind of a meditation on the mind itself. So we're asking the question, we're entering into vipassana here, just asking the question with or without words, who is visualizing the Buddha? Or what is it that is visualizing the Buddha? We're not trying to answer, we're just resting in wherever that question leaves us. And Ken's answer is always, we can't say who or what it is. We can't identify it. Dinga Chensi Rinpoche says, you will become aware that it is the mind that is perceiving the visualization. So we could rest for a moment in that realization that what we're looking at is actually the mind itself. You will also see that the image you are visualizing is not itself actually the Buddha who came into this world, but rather a projection created by your mind in order to develop focus. So continuing to rest in who is it that is seeing this visualization? Where is the visualization located? If you ask that. Rest in that. Or as Lama Norla Rinpoche often instructed us, we could rest in the essence of the one who or that which is visualizing the Buddha. So Dingo Chensei continues with this vipassana or insight aspect of meditation. The mind has the ability to focus on an object, yet when you search for the mind, you cannot find it anywhere. As we saw earlier, if you look inward at the mind, this would be in the ultimate bodhicitta verses, if you look inward at the mind and try to locate it or identify its shape, its color, its form, where it came from, where it is now, or where it goes to, you will never find anything. So we could go through those. We have the visualization, so we're not talking about that now because we're looking at the mind that is visualizing now. And we ask whether the mind that is visualizing has a shape. Does it have a color? Does it have a location? Again, not trying to answer the question, but simply resting in the looking. So he's going to take us a little bit through as we continue to meditate here. He's going to take us through a little bit of examination of the mind. He says, all phenomena in their infinite variety throughout the universe in fact appear as a result of particular causes and conditions coming temporarily together. You take phenomena to be things that truly exist simply because you have not examined them properly. In truth, they have no solid intrinsic existence at all. When it becomes clear that your body, your own body that you're sitting in the chair with, the image of the Buddha you are visualizing, and all phenomena are the display of the mind, and that the mind's nature is empty, simply remain in the recognition of that nature without wandering, remaining attentive to whether or not thoughts interrupt this recognition. This is called profound insight, or vipassana. So here we've asked the questions, and we've rested in our, you know, however we see it. And now we're resting in awareness of the emptiness of the object of meditation, the mind itself that's looking, and our physical characteristics, just remaining in the recognition of that nature, that none of them have solid, inherent, identifiable, consistent existence, but they are all aspects of the mind or part of the mind itself. Again, we're not analyzing, so let go of any thought processes you may be engaged in about this, simply resting, and as he says, continuing to notice thoughts and sensory perceptions that come into your sort of field of perception. some quotes here from Jalsei Topme or Topme Zangpo, our author of 37 Practices, but this is not from the 37 Practices text, although it's related. Very similar to verse 21 on the like resting in the nature of mind. Topme Zangpo says, all appearances are one's own mind, so we can continue to meditate, just letting these words flow into our consciousness and out. All appearances are one's own mind. Mind itself is primordially, meaning always from the beginning, beyond conceptual extremes. Undistracted by dualistic subject-object notions, to remain one-pointed is called perfect concentration or focus. So we'll continue to rest just for another minute. The visualization of the Buddha is still there. We don't have to focus intently on it. But just aware of the presence of the Buddha visualized in the sky in front. From the point of view of both resting in that, which is calm abiding, and knowing that, knowing its nature, that its nature is emptiness and luminosity, same as us. And that's insight. So now we will, you don't have to officially dissolve the visualization. The Buddha could stay with you if you want, but we're just going to bring our attention slowly, gradually back to our study. We don't need to lose touch, though, with that sense of the ultimate reality of ourselves and our computer and our the content of our study, that all of it is just passing phenomena and inherently just the union of emptiness and luminosity, just like the visualization of the Buddha. So next we're only going to chant a few verses today. I forgot to set up the screen share before, so I'll just take a second. Does anybody have anything they need to say or ask before we chant the verses? Okay. Oh, I see. So today we are just going to chant together the six paramitas, or the five paramitas at this point. Starting with verse 25. And I'm going to offer, like, for those who like to chant all the verses together, it's taking up so much class time now that I don't want to do it for the next few classes, but I'm going to offer an alternative way of doing that at the end of the class. So verse 25, beginning of the six paramitas. If wishing to attain awakening, I need to give even my body up, then doesn't it go also without saying that this applies to mere external stuff without hope for reward or benefit? To generously give away a gift. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If through a lack of ethical conduct, I can't accomplish my own benefit, then any aspiration to achieve the benefit of others is a joke. To keep and guard my ethical conduct, completely free from worldly influence, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. For bodhisattvas wishing to accrue a wealth of wholesome virtue and good deeds, all harm is like a precious treasure trove from other people or adversity. To cultivate a patient attitude, not feeling irritated or abused, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. If listeners and solitary Buddhas, in striving just for their own benefit, are seen to focus with the same resolve as putting out a fire on their head, since my aim is to benefit all beings, and effort is the source of all good traits, I must engage with joyful perseverance. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And today's verse we will chant 3 times to attain complete and stable meditation. To vanquish my emotionality, I need insight based in tranquility. To understand this and to cultivate a stable, focused, meditative state, not getting stuck in the 4 formless realms, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. To vanquish my emotionality, I need insight based in tranquility. To understand this and to cultivate a stable, focused, meditative state, not getting stuck in the 4 formless realms, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. To vanquish my emotionality, I need insight based in tranquility. To understand this and to cultivate a stable, focused, meditative state, not getting stuck in the 4 formless realms, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So, John, I'm just letting you know, because I don't remember when you start recording, but I'm going to talk about the verse a little bit while we still have it on screen share, and then we will go to the commentaries. So the point here is to vanquish my emotionality. And I use the word emotionality. It's substituting for emotional reactivity, emotional afflictions, emotional poisons, disturbing emotions, conflicting emotions, all the many names by which we call them. And we all know what we're talking about, right? Desire, anger, ignorance, desire, anger, pride, and so forth. Read so forth. So in calm abiding, we learn to tame them, to not be carried away by them. But here we're talking about something deeper than that, actually uprooting them, vanquishing them. Like they don't, like we're talking here about that ideal state of patience, to be unperturbed by anything. How do we become unperturbed by anything? We cut the root of our emotionality. And how do we do that? Well, what tamed our emotions was tranquility or calm abiding meditation, but we need insight in order to completely vanquish them. And insight means seeing their true nature, which is what we just talked about with Dingo Chensei Rinpoche, that the nature of everything is impermanent. It's emptiness in union with luminosity, the union of emptiness and luminosity. It's the nature of mind. It's like there's really nothing happening. There's nothing real happening. It's like an illusion. It's like a dream. It's like yesterday's weather. If we understand that, then the emotions don't even need to come up. Or if they do start to come up, then we immediately apply the remedy, which is to recognize their emptiness. It's a process. You know, we can't do it just by understanding it intellectually, but that's why we need this kind of meditation. So this verse, like the name of it is, the word is translated as, often translated as concentration or absorption. Tony Duff in the great online dictionary, Tibetan dictionary, the Illuminator says it also can refer to just meditation. So this verse clarifies what is meant by it in this context. It's complete and stable meditation. Like, it's not partial meditation, which is what's going to lead us into the four formless realms, which we will talk about more in class. But it's the complete meditation of calm abiding combined with insight. That and completely stabilized, like not just a glimpse, but like all the time. So that's the fifth paramita, is to work to cultivate that state. So the four formless realms we will talk about, we'll talk about in class. It's just a place, like that's a path towards, everybody says it better than me, but basically it's just a path towards complete calm abiding. Like nothing bothers you because you're sitting in meditation. Like your meditation is impenetrable, and it becomes more and more refined. But should you ever get up from the meditation cushion, it's not there anymore, because it only works in when you're completely focused in meditation. So that those are good states, but they're not complete meditation. We don't want to get stuck there thinking that we attained enlightenment when all we have attained is perfect calm abiding meditation. So I'm going to stop the screen share now. Whoops. And I'm going to ask if anybody has any questions. This is a good time, or any comments to make. Did you enjoy the Buddha meditation? Yes, I'm Ann. I'm going to unmute you. My cursor is slow today. Okay, you're unmuted.
Okay, now I can't find it. I had a question about something that was said in the commentary. There's something now. I'm sorry. I thought I had it, but I don't.
Okay, if you find it, you can ask.
That a beginning meditator has clarity but not stability. And I was wondering if you could sort of explain the clarity aspect of a beginning meditator. I'll look for the sentence.
Yeah, I remember reading that. I don't remember which commentary it's in. It's probably in Nyingma Chense, right?
Yeah.
And so we may get to that. I'm not sure that I can elucidate beyond his words, though.
Okay.
I'm not sure that I can. So let's just focus, like, not worry too much about what clarity means. I think it just means, you know, like a state of being in the present moment, because that seems to be, you know, what it would be. I'll get to you in just a moment, Jinsang. She may have the answer. But what we're focusing on in that is that what we need to develop is stability. So I'm unmuting you now, Jinsang.
I think this might have to do with what comes to my mind is this notion that ordinary mind, Tamalaji Shepa, but just that the state of the nature of mind is always with us, so that even the beginner has just like clarity itself, which is merely the aspect of mind that experiences that, you know, all of whatever we experience, whatever phenomena arises, there is a knowingness, or knowingness, but there is awareness of that. And that is with all beings, beginners and fully enlightened Buddhas. It is not different in that the difference is that the beginner sees that and gets confused, thinking there's someone that's aware of something other, etc. And the Buddha, having recognized that the true nature, there is, you know, is no duality. My point being is, I think that in that sense, the beginner always has this, you know, the mind itself is the same for all beings, whether they're enlightened or not, this clarity aspect, this ability, you know, is just that for beginners, instead of thinking, well, what is arising in my mind? I'm projecting externally and exist outside of my mind, etc. But there must be, I don't know, in context of the stability, whether it's referring to the stability, which then is aware of what that clarity actually is. I'm not really sure what that's referring to, stability, but it would seem that the stability, the beginner has it, just all beings have it. It's just whether you recognize or are aware of how to perceive that, or how you're perceiving that. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Jinsong. I think the stability generally in these commentaries, stability is referring to keeping it going. Like you could have a state of clarity, like a state of very clear awareness in the present moment. But the trick is to keep that, like to not keep losing it to distraction. So that's, you know, and that's partly what Jinzong was telling us too. Okay, anybody else? All right, we have, John, we have a lot of really good material today to cover. Anything we don't cover, I'll put online. Yeah, John.
Yeah, I've always had problem with recognizing emotion. And you mentioned emotionality as part of this description. So can you speak a little about, thoughts are easy for me because they're there, but emotions don't seem to manifest in the same way. So is it more of a feeling or is it, I don't understand.
Yeah, okay. I think the meditation chapter in Ornament of Precious Liberation is very helpful on this. So emotions and thoughts are very closely interrelated, and in Tibetan, like Namtok is like the whole ball of like when you get involved in conceptuality, which is either emotional or specifically what we would call a thought. But for me, like can help to lead us through that too. You may recall that, so we all know what a thought is, right? So you're saying you get like looking at thoughts, but what does it mean to look at an emotion? It's more the feeling, I think. That feeling of anger. Pema Chodron, for example, suggests that when we find ourselves caught up in an emotion, that the first step would be to drop the storyline, the thoughts about it, as distinct from the feeling of it, and just rest in the feeling of it, which is sort of in our body. But even Ken McLeod in that, you know, in the meditation that I emailed everybody from his commentary on whichever ultimate bodhicitta verse it was, said that when we look at emotion, we know how to separate that from the thought, but the more subtle step is like to separate it from the feeling in our body. So he said, when we look at emotion arising, to look at how it feels in our body, like notice what the effect is in our body, and then how is the emotion a different thing from that, and rest in that, because we're looking for the emotion itself. So I don't know if that helped clarify it or not, but I think it's the best I can do. Did that help, John? Okay. All right, I'm going to mute you again. Does anybody have anything pressing to say? Because I'd like to move on to the commentaries, but everybody's welcome to speak if they have something. All right, so we're first going to look a little bit more at Dingo Chense Rinpoche. He begins the chapter on page 164 with an important paragraph that may sound like just completely obvious. He says, examine body, speech, and mind, and you will find that mind is the most important of the three. We hear that a lot in a lot of teachings. If your mind is thoroughly trained in sustained calm and profound insight, which is the kind of meditation that we just did, which he's leading up to here, your body and your speech will naturally follow your mind along the path of liberation. So if we work on taming our mind, we don't have to worry about separately taming our speech, you know, restraining our speech and separately restraining our actions. Like, look at the mind, because that's where it's all coming from. And if we can tame and then vanquish this emotionality, these emotional reactions in our mind, then our speech and our body will naturally fall into line. They won't, it's our mind that tells them what to do. So we don't have to worry about lashing out if we can work with our mind not being disturbed. So I'm going to skip ahead to page 165, because he brings up here important points that are brought up in every text. We studied this, like Gampopa in Ornament of Precious Liberation, a long section on the basis for meditation. So that's what he's going to talk about here. He says, to gain stability in concentration, by which he means meditation here, it is helpful to stay in quiet, secluded retreat places, free from distractions. So that, in one sentence, summarizes Gampopa's entire description, which is also extremely helpful, of seclusion, of what he calls seclusion of body and mind. We first find a place that is where we won't be disturbed. It could be like a retreat if we're very fortunate, or it could just be a corner of your house at a time of day when nobody's going to bother you. That seclusion of the body, you just get away from distractions. But then you have to separately seclude the mind, which means you make up your mind that you're not going to get distracted into thoughts, into thinking. Like, thoughts are still always allowed, but you're not going to get distracted into actually thinking. And I'm going to read a little passage from Geshe Jangpa Tegcho on this, because he has a very nice description that, again, is much shorter than Gampopa's. If you want the full explanation, Ornament of Precious Liberation, Meditation Paramita. So he says, in general, calm abiding is best developed during meditation retreat. A peaceful, isolated place is conducive for this. And that means, you know, again, we may not be able to go to a separate place to do retreat, but just have a place in your home where you can seclude yourself somewhat. In addition, it is essential that our mind also be isolated, or I think secluded is a better translation, that is, not have much conceptualization. So that's what's meant by seclusion of the mind, is not to engage in thinking, not to engage in conceptualization. And that is a resolution that we make. That's how we place our mind in meditation. We won't be able to do it. We won't be able to sustain it because meditation is training. So the resolution here is, well, I'm not going to get distracted into thinking, but when I do get distracted into thinking, which will probably happen a lot, I will always bring myself back. I will notice it and bring myself back to a state of mental seclusion from distraction. He says, conceptualization occurs when our mind is busy thinking all sorts of things, such as, I need this, I'm going to do that, he should do this, why aren't things going the way I want them to, and so forth. We have to train ourselves to abandon all thoughts that are tainted by the three poisonous attitudes. In general, we don't have to avoid positive thoughts, but to attain calm abiding, even positive thinking is to be temporarily abandoned. Whether we are in an isolated place or in the midst of a crowd, we should try to let go of all useless conceptualization, for then we will be able to engage in virtue. So he's suggesting this is something that we could take out into the world with us, this kind of mental seclusion of just not getting caught up in it. Just don't get caught up in whatever's going on. So that is on our cushion or in a crowd, out shopping, whatever we're doing at work. We have the choice, and that's what we learn through meditation, is that we have a choice whether to get caught up or not get caught up. And gradually through training, we become more and more able to not get caught up. Because if we don't put a damper on our rambling conceptualization, then staying alone in a place is not much use, because we will just sit and think about all sorts of other things. So seclusion of the body is not enough. It's not enough of a condition. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition for meditation. You also have to apply seclusion of mind. He also says, and this is just free advice, it's not specifically on the point, but he says, when doing retreat, it is also important to have few needs and to be content. And I think Kala Rinpoche gave that advice to all Dharma practitioners. If you want to be a serious Dharma practitioner, it's important to have few needs and be content with what you have. This is very important, for without it, our mind will go to objects of attachment and try to procure them. And I can tell you, this happens in three-year retreat. The mind thinks of what it doesn't have, and it wants it, and it sometimes writes letters and procures it. And we will not have time to practice the Dharma, and that's the tragedy. So that's just some extra free advice. So back to Dzingo Chense Rinpoche. So he's just given us that one sentence of saying we need seclusion of body and mind. He says, of sustained calm and profound insight are two meditation methods. It is profound insight that is the most important. But profound insight cannot arise without a preliminary calming of the mind. So that is why in our tradition we generally teach shine or calm abiding first. That's level one of our Dharma Path program. And then at some point, which we haven't gotten to yet in the Dharma Path program, you introduce insight meditation once you've attained a relative calm abiding. What is crucial here is to calm all the wild thoughts that constantly agitate, unsettle, and condition your mind, for such thoughts give rise to negative emotions, which in turn you express as the words and actions that comprise the causes of suffering. And I've heard this expressed really well in an online discussion recently, that what we're learning in meditation is to not let those thoughts and emotions own our body, speech, and mind. Like, when our mind is untamed, we're owned by whatever comes down the pike. And so through meditation, we learn to not engage, to simply observe and not engage, and just engage to whatever extent we need to engage to get the job done. Let's see if there's anything else I wanted to read from here. Most of the chapter is actually we did as the meditation. So, okay. So he says, he says techniques of concentration, of focus, this is calm abiding, are found in many paths, but they should not be confused with, he says, Buddhist methods, as they are not practiced with the same goal. So this is about what are the four formless meditations or four formless realms. Such contemplations that are just focused on building up your ability to concentrate and calm the mind, instead of being aimed at true enlightenment, are undertaken with the idea of bringing the elements to exhaustion, transcending form, thus they are formless meditations, and attaining a state of absorption in the formless realms as their ultimate goal. So that's what we don't want to get caught up in. And so the rest of the chapter is the guided meditation. I'm going to have a sip of water. I encourage you to do the same if you need it. And so next we are going to look at Tenpo Sutren Jamsa Rinpoche very briefly. First, he tells us what the four formless realms are, and we're not going to go into it in any depth because it's something we're not engaging in. But then he says something really helpful that I haven't seen anyone else say. So first he says, among the three realms, so we have the six realms of samsara, right? Everybody knows the six realms. And then there's another way of describing samsara as three realms, the desire realm, which includes all of the six realms of samsara, and the form and formless realms, which are other than what we know as the six realms, but they're still within samsara. So among the three realms, the highest is the formless realm, which is reached through samadhi or meditative stability. That is the name of this paramita. So we already got the point here, right? Did anybody pick that up? Among the three realms, the highest is formless. The three realms of what? Of samsara. So within these three realms, there is no freedom from samsara. So yeah, he says samadhi has four levels. That's the four formless realms, namely, and these are the names of them. The first one's called infinite space. And if we have time, Ken MacLeod has such a beautiful description of what these actually are in meditative experience. Four levels. Infinite space is the first formless level. Infinite consciousness is the second. And they could have different translations. Third one is complete nothingness. And the fourth one is peak of existence. So remembering that existence is a synonym for samsara, you're still in samsara, but it's the highest point. So he says, the highest, most subtle of these is peak of existence. Within all existence, all samsara, no state is higher. But no matter how subtle peak of existence may be, it still lies within the three realms. So no matter how refined, no matter how good your calm abiding meditation gets, that's as far as it's going to take you. It is not going to cross the border of samsara into freedom. So he says, therefore, to conquer afflictions, meaning emotional afflictions, and transcend suffering, our meditation must go beyond all existence. So it has to go beyond the four formless realms, and that is what the verse says. He says, transcendence of samsara requires superior knowledge. That's like a synonym for insight. The wisdom that realizes the selflessness of all phenomena. And for UKDC Sangha members, that's what we were talking about on Sunday, is Transcendence of samsara requires superior knowledge of the wisdom. I don't know what I was just going to say. But anyway, how does superior knowledge manifest when vipassana, analytic or insight meditation, that's that second part, arises from shamatha or calm abiding? Again, that's what the verse says. We need insight that is based in calm abiding. Then the two become one. When you are in calm abiding and insight meditation arises naturally from that, the two become one. And this union, known as samten, again, that's the name of the paramita, or stable meditation, activates superior knowledge within our samadhi. So we reach a state of seeing. Of insight. That's what I was going to say, is that this state of, that state is the third path, the path of seeing, is what I was going to say. It's the first level of an official bodhisattva. So here's the thing he says that nobody else says that I think is just really, really helpful. The fifth paramita, the Tibetan is samten, which I'm calling complete and stable meditation, is the key to unlocking the wisdom that realizes emptiness. So that's the progression of the paramitas, right? We all know that. And those of us who have studied Gampopa know that he says in the generosity chapter, or actually probably before that, the introduction to all the paramitas, that they're in order, like one unfolds from the next. So there's like a natural progression. You start with generosity and ethical conduct develops from that. And once you have ethical conduct, then patience develops from that. Not that you don't practice them all at the same time, but you tend to sort of master them in that order. So naturally, meditation would come before wisdom. But I just loved that he said the fifth paramita is the key to unlocking the wisdom that realizes emptiness, which is the sixth paramita. He says, through samten, meditation, one completely conquers affliction and suffering, goes beyond the four states of samadhi, the four formless realms, and transcends all existence, meaning gets out of samsara. One is liberated from samsara. Therefore, stable meditation is the practice of a bodhisattva. And then he says it has four qualities. Turns out they all have four qualities, and we're not going to go over those. Anybody have any questions or comments at this point? Okay, Jinzang, Lama Jinzang, I'm going to unmute you.
I just wanted to double check. I think the answer came clear when he just read the last sentence, but that's his commentary. Mm-hmm. Kenpo Zoltram Johnson Rinpoche's commentary on the 37 practices. That's what you were reading from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Sorry. Did I not say that?
You just prefaced saying it's Kenpo Jomso Rinpoche, but not from that text. So that's
okay.
Why.
Yeah, that's we've used it all through the class. So.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. You missed that, but thank you for clarifying that point.
Okay.
Anything else? Okay. So next we are going to look at a little bit from Pema Chödrön. And it's just she's just sharing here. This is from her. This is Pema Chödrön from my notes from her her seminar at Omega in 2016 or 2017 on the 37 practices. She just shares with regard to the meditation paramita that the first instruction that Trungpa Rinpoche gave his students was just sit down and open to whatever arises in your mind. Like he started with that. If your thoughts carry you off, just come back to open awareness of whatever arises in your mind. This is shine, or calm abiding without an object. So he introduced that first. And that is like the lead-in point to insight meditation, is just resting in open awareness. Lama Norlin Rinpoche always called it, he said it's called the king of samadhi. It's called the king of calm abiding methods, because it's the borderline of nature of mind meditation. So she also says, she brings it back into the realm of paramitas, like what makes them all paramitas? Let's all Google our brain for that for a moment. What makes generosity a paramita as opposed to like something that will take us to enlightenment as opposed to just a virtuous act? What makes ethical conduct or patience or perseverance or meditation, a transcending action. She says, do this meditation, do this free of an idea of meditator, meditation and result. Do it with a mind that is free of conceptual limitations. And so the sixth paramita, which we'll look at next week, is going to, that is going to bring the transcendence to all of the paramitas, the transcending actions. So now we're going to look at His Holiness, the 17th Karmapa, or Jintrin Trinley Dorje. And I think that's the last one before we get to Ken MacLeod. So we still have plenty of time. I thought we might run short today. So again, this is Traveling the Path of Compassion by His Holiness, the 17th Karmapa. I think it was written a while back. His translation is by Michelle Martin, and oral translation by Ringu Tulku and Michelle Martin. And the translation in writing was by Michelle Martin. We know these people, so I'm mentioning that. This was written in 2009, so he wrote this almost 10 years ago. And he's still, you know, better would put him in his early 20s. So you may recall that what he has been bringing to the table on this that no one else has been bringing to the table is the demon, the corresponding demon for each paramita, like how that paramita can go wrong. So he says, meditation, the fifth perfection, has a demon called attachment to experience. And this is a big demon that most meditators struggle with. I see people nodding. I see Marilyn nodding. We've all met this one. And it's a really subtle demon. I mean, it's a tough one. And I remember, you know, going to Lamanorla Rinpoche, you know, and telling him what's happening in your meditation, he pretty much always says the same thing, like, neither good nor bad, just keep meditating. Because he doesn't want us to get attached to our meditation experiences. So, but to go back to the Karmapa, it is not easy to fully understand meditative experience. The verse refers to formless states of meditation, which are categorized as follows, and he uses a slightly different translation here. Limitless space, first one. Limitless consciousness, the second one. Nothing whatsoever, the third one. And neither existence nor non-existence, the fourth one. So he's talking about real borderline between samsara and awakening. Because it's neither, at that point when you reach the absolute pinnacle, it's like almost there. It's, you can't say for sure which one it is, except that you know you're not going to go any further without some help, according to Ornament of Precious Liberation. He says, much has been written about these four formless states, but they lie outside the main point here, so he's not going to talk about them either. What we need to know is that when we meditate, all sorts of experiences will come, both good and not so good. Let's think back on our meditation. Like, what feels like a good, productive meditation session? Like, you know you really had a good meditation. And then, like, what feels like, God, I just wasted half an hour. that's what he's talking about. Whether it feels good, like, this is it, I got it. Or whether it feels like, oh, crap, you know, I'm never gonna be awakened. That second kind of laziness for you KDC people and everybody else who studied perseverance. Oh, we studied that last week, didn't we? Here, thinking you're not good enough. Oh God, I'm never going to be a meditator. I'm never going to get out of samsara. I'm never even going to get calm abiding. So these experiences, however, are not important. Here the key is the extent to which our meditation serves as an antidote to our afflictions. How many obscurations and how many afflictions have been subdued or cleared away? This is the true test of meditation. Not what wonderful or special experiences we might have. In fact, if we become attached to these experiences, that is a problem. And in fact, it's traditionally called a demon, the demon of meditation. If you become attached to your experiences and not be satisfied with your meditation, if it's not the way you're expecting to experience it, the way you think meditation should feel, then, you know, you think you didn't accomplish anything. But he says something here that's really helpful that I just read and everybody probably got, but nevertheless, I'm going to explain it again, that we know the way that we judge our meditation, and, you know, I mean judge just in the sense of assess, like, am I progressing, is not like, am I having good meditation experiences and feeling like calm and joyful and peaceful in meditation. It's like, well, am I getting angry less often? Like, when anger arises, am I able to, like, not be bothered, not lash out, not hold a grudge? If we find that we're progressing in those ways, like in our emotional reactivity becoming less strong and owning us less, then we're progressing. And then it doesn't matter, like, if our meditation feels like a complete mess because it's working. So that's the Karmapa. Any questions or comments before we look at our last commentary, Ken McLeod, who's going to do his usual thing. When he succeeds, it's really lovely, of just putting us into the midst of it in terms that we naturally understand. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions or comments, so we'll look at this, and we may have a few minutes left over at the end. Someone is cleaning my gutters at this moment. Hopefully it won't be loud. Might distract me. All right, so Ken McLeod's commentary. So we're going to skip. We're not going to read the whole thing. So he starts out talking about gaining some sort of stability on the cushion. Like, we meditate, we do breath meditation, we do open awareness, we do sensory meditation, and we, you know, we're making progress. He says, but we can make a lot of progress in calm abiding, as we've learned in the other commentaries. But he said, and you can feel like, okay, I know how to meditate. But he said, in fact, the only time you are the way you want to be is when you are meditating. Like, we can't take it off the cushion with us. And this is what stability is all about. he says, the only time you are the way you want to be is when you are meditating in retreat or in some other intensive practice environment. In the rest of your life, practice seems to make little difference in how you interact with others. We can all reflect on that. And that is what the Karmapa just gave us, right, as the way to measure our progress. Is it affecting the way that we interact with others when we are off the cushion? If not, something's missing. So he says, off the cushion, you are thrown off by thoughts that come out of nowhere and by emotional reactions that take you unaware. You see again and again the same patterns of behavior in your life, and you cannot understand the growing disparity between your meditation experience, which is so fabulous, and the experience of everyday life, where you devolve into a total mess. He says, perhaps if you go further and still your mind even more, and here's where he's going to take us through the four formless meditations or realms, and that's why it's useful to know their names, because that's the only way that you know what he's doing here, is if you know the names of them. Perhaps if you could go further and still your mind even more, like even more calm abiding, you could just make your calm abiding better and better, maybe that would solve the problem. Then you could be free of thoughts and thinking completely. So first you rest in infinite space, utterly still and at peace. It is as if you have no body, but there is still a subtle sense of confinement and restriction. So what he's done there is describe how it might feel to be in the first formless realm. Resting in infinite space, no body, like sort of disembodied, just floating, but still with a subtle sense of confinement. So you take it to the next level. You rest more deeply in infinite consciousness. The sense of restriction is gone, but you still do not feel free. You rest still more deeply. Now there is nothing at all. Nothing, that is, except a vague sense of you. So in each one, he's identifying what is like the limitation of that formless realm, just for those of us who are interested. In the first one, our consciousness is still restricting us. Second one, we got rid of that, but our sense of self, there's still a subtle sense of self that's restricting us. And then the stillness deepens even further to the point that you cannot tell whether you perceive anything or not. The stillness and peace is extraordinary, but you do not see where it leads. So that's an interesting clarification. When we ran across that in the Karmapas, the Karmapa called it neither existence nor non-existence. And I took that maybe in the wrong way, as existence meaning samsara. But here, there's an interesting thing that happens when you study Mahamudra, and that is a terminology thing. And I just really noticed it and focused on it recently. We've always called them appearances. You know, there's the emptiness of self and there's the emptiness of appearances. But in some texts, and I'm especially noticing this in Mingyur Rinpoche, he doesn't call them appearances, he calls them perceptions. So the state that Ken's describing here is where we don't have any perception of anything happening. Like our meditation is so focused, it's so concentrated that it has closed off any other perceptions. And that is actually considered a virtue on that path. Like that's, I know people who practice like that. We have a new person in our Richmond group recently who is on the Theravada path. And he says his concentration is really good. And that's great. You know, that's a wonderful thing to be able to do. But in the Mahayana path, it's considered to be a little bit of a dead end because you can't actually free yourself from samsara by reaching a more closed off state of like perfectly still meditation. So Ken continues, these four states are amazing experiences. So we're not denigrating those states. Those are amazing accomplishments. They just, according to the Mahayana path, they don't take us all the way to the end. And in Ornament of Precious Liberation, in the first chapter on Buddha nature, when Gampopa talks about the five families or the five different kinds of connection you can have to your Buddha nature, that is the problem with the Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha paths, is that they define awakening, they define enlightenment, they define nirvana as complete peace. But it's your own peace. And you may recall, Gampopa says that's the third obstacle to full enlightenment, is getting stuck in peace, like personal, your own peace. So these four states are amazing experiences, Ken says, all of them, but something is still missing. Although you can still the mind to an extraordinary degree, when you try to live your life from that stillness or in that stillness, it does not work. As soon as you move, the stillness is gone. This is not what you expected, and you do not know where to go now. So in Ornament of Precious Liberation, it's said that these, like when people are what we would call stuck in those states, those formless states of perfect calm abiding meditation, perfect peace and calm, the Buddha at some point sends out a ray of light to wake them up a little bit, and they realize that they still have further to go. Like they're stuck in their own personal peace, but like, what now? So Ken goes through a couple of paragraphs of a metaphor of how our meditation practice is like being in a kayak. Like calm abiding is like learning to sail. Do you say sail a kayak, paddle a kayak in a calm sea? But if all you know with your kayak is how to not turn over in a calm, you know, a calm sea, like when you hit the rapids, you're gone. We have rapids here on our river in Richmond, and a lot of people kayak there, and sometimes they do turn over, and occasionally they die because they didn't know how to do the rapids. Like, they were fine with the river, but oh my God, what do you do when the rapids are boiling up? So he says, and it's worth reading the whole chapter just for, you know, for this too. So he goes on to say, there is a difference between the freedom of a still mind, which is a big freedom. That's like the arhatship, no more suffering, and the freedom of no mind. So the freedom of a still mind, he says, is like kayaking in still water. It is peaceful. You can direct attention wherever you choose, and it rests there because you are so still. Wouldn't we all like to have that ability, that capacity? I mean, we're working on, you know, on being able to have our mind restful and not perturbed. But he says, it is almost useless in regular life. And that is why the verse says to vanquish emotionality, like to really vanquish emotionality, which that thing that gets, like when our button is pushed, we react. To vanquish that, it's not enough to have a still mind in meditation, to be able to have completely focused mind. We have to also have insight into the emptiness of that person pushing our button, and the emptiness of the button, and the emptiness of the issue that they're pushing our button with. So he says, the freedom of no mind is like kayaking with no fixed point inside you, meaning like you just go with the flow, right? You are not separate from what you experience. You are not watching it. You're just like, you go through the rapids and you just sort of naturally adjust. And then you hit another still point and you're going, and then you hit some more rapids and you just go with it. Like whatever's coming at you, you just go with it. it doesn't interrupt your flow. So Ken says, how do you do that? You look again and again at what cannot be seen, your own mind. So you could at this point go back to his commentary on, I think it was verse 22, which is the meditation, the ultimate bodhicitta meditation verse. You look again and again at what cannot be seen, your own mind. Stillness does help with that looking. That's why we need our basis in calm abiding, because we have to be able to have a clear, focused mind in order to look and see. So stillness does help with that looking. It helps a lot. Yet stillness by itself, even the extraordinary stillness of infinite space, infinite consciousness, and so on, is not enough. You have to see, and to see, you have to look. Look again and again at what cannot be seen. At some point, if you keep looking, you see nothing. You really see nothing. Like, we think we see nothing, but at some point, if we practice it enough, Ken says, we really see nothing, and that might be a little bit different. I think that would be like the path of seeing and the first level of a bodhisattva, like when you really directly realize it, really got it. You know through your own experience that there is no you in you, no fixed point, nothing. That experience makes all the difference. When you really see how the Ringu Tulpa put it, that the experiencer is the experience. The experience is the experiencer. Or I have a quote that I just wrote down from Mingyur Rinpoche. There is no difference between what is seen and the mind that sees it. Same thing, right? So that experience, when you really, really connect with that, that makes all the difference. As thoughts, feelings, and sensations arise in your life, you experience them without any fixed reference point. You're in that kayak, and it doesn't matter if it's rapids. Like, you don't need it to be still. You don't need an anchor. You just keep going no matter what. So as thoughts, feelings, and sensations arise, they are not other. You move with them and through them, just like you move with and through the ocean waves in a kayak. So what do you do about thoughts, feelings, and sensations? Would we like to anticipate Ken's answer? What do we do with thoughts, feelings, and sensations? Let's contemplate that for a moment. My Kindle just thought I wasn't interacting with it enough. What do you do about thoughts, feelings, and sensations? Nothing. They are free, completely free to come and go on their own, just like the waves in the ocean. So that's the analogy that's used throughout the literature of meditation, is that the waves are no different from the ocean, and in the same way that thoughts and emotions are no different from the mind itself. If mind is empty and limitless and luminous, then so are thoughts and emotions. And as Ken says, so are you. Why? Because you have lost your mind, he says. I think that's very cute. Very cute, Ken. Okay, that is like all that I got. We can do a little housekeeping stuff. There's a couple of things I want to talk about. But does anybody have any questions or comments? We got about 8 minutes left. Lama Jinzong, you got anything you would like to say? Yes, I'm going to unmute you. We'd love to hear from you, Lama Jinzong.
Okay. You know, this whole thing about mind, and you know, I can work. I've come to recognize, or at least instance where I get it. But still, like, even now, like, I'm actually looking. It's hilarious. I'm in my parents' living room and see this chair. Can you see that chair in front of the door? Well, so here I am looking, and that's the backdrop or the venue in which I'm imagining the Buddha.
He's got the chair.
Well, no, but the Buddha is nowhere and whatever.
Yeah, I'm seeing him in the chair.
But the interesting thing, and this is, you know, that it says finally that, you know, I guess it's in the Dingo Rinpoche, Dingo Kenzi Rinpoche thing, of that finally, you know, it's not just that your mind and your visualization, but that ultimately all phenomena are your mind. And in a certain way, Dad, can you get that? I'm still in. Okay, sorry.
stemness was just broken.
No, whatever.
Kayak is still going.
But, you know, in a certain way, this that Mingyur Rinpoche actually refers, instead of appearances, says perception, because in terms of phenomena being your mind,
yeah.
I get a better, it's easier actually think, it's the perception of phenomena, because what I learned years ago is like, when I see form of any kind in a reflection, like in the mirror, or like if I'm on the train going to New York, and you know, you're in Grand Central Station underground, and it's completely light in the train, but you're looking out, and you're like seeing in the reflection, in the window of the train, the people that are actually walking through the interior of the train.
Yeah.
The point is that even though I so know that they are in the train and not outside, you know, where the reflection is, the minute I see that reflection, boom, there's such an intensely interior, you know, innate habit to think that's real.
Yeah.
Those are real people. Those are real. That this notion that exterior phenomena, it's all we have is, it's just like that chair I was looking at, that it's just a coarse perception, you know, and that's as a human being, that's what I have to deal with, is that somehow we have to work and work and work. I can get it with, okay, interior, the mind, the thoughts, the visions, you know, whatever, that's illusory. I get that. But that immediate thing, that what we see, the minute I see any sort of form, boom, there's some inherent reality is so deeply ingrained. It's tough. And one of the last things I started doing was, one time I was teaching at Salman Kunchup, and I was early, and so there's of course a Starbucks that's up the road, and I'm sitting at the window, you know, at the out, looking outside of Starbucks, you know, sitting there, and again my reflection in the mirror, and it's like in the window, and I'm like, that's not me, that's not real. And I actually went and started looking on Googling images of holograms to try to get that sense of the image that's inherently nothing but light, you know, nothing but phenomena coming together. That none of this is anything other than coarse perception.
Yeah. It's like the turkey pecking the bumper, right?
Yep. And it's like boom, boom, boom.
Another turkey.
But it's so deeply ingrained that the minute I see anything that I conceive of as form, it's not just form, it's real. It's a very deep habit to cut through.
Yes. Yes, thank you. I think that's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. There's a wonderful moment. And just to take another minute, there's a wonderful moment. There's like, I think this might be online, I'm not sure. Some of us have old VHS tapes of it, of Kalu Rinpoche teaching, I think it's called Nature of Mind. It might be called Mahamudra. And Yeshe Jamto was translating it when he was like between his two retreats, 1986. It was like one of his first public translations. And there's this moment in it where there's a crash off stage. And Yeshe Jamto, in the middle of his translation, goes like that. And Kalu Rinpoche goes like that, but he's not looking off stage. He's looking at Yeshe Jamto. And it's like, you didn't get it yet, did you? I mean, that's what I think he's thinking now. I have no idea what Kalu Rinpoche was thinking or what he was doing. But it's just this very subtle, lovely moment. And I think of that, like when I hear something outside and I go like that, I think, where is that sound really taking place? And that's why I actually like saying perception instead of appearance, although they mean the same thing, they're interchangeable, and you could use either one in either place. Perception locates it more like it's not a thing outside. It makes it clear that we're talking about your perception of the thing. Yes, Jinzhang.
Well, actually, though, I don't actually necessarily think, at least relatively, they are the same thing, because appearance, like the consciousness of form, all the consciousnesses of form, of sound, of speech, those are non-conceptual, where there's some sort of experience, but it's before conception. And at least in my feeble brain, perception somehow implies, and maybe this is the wrong word, that there's some sort of at the point conceptual process that is now perceiving something as something.
Yeah.
Something
it's not people. Actually what's meant.
Okay, what is
that? And I only know that because Mingyur Rinpoche substitutes perception for appearance in his Mahamudra teachings. And
that's okay.
Talking about the same thing, which I didn't get for a long time. Like, what is this perceptions? I don't remember ever hearing about that before. And then
I'm thinking maybe perception in my mind then is like discrimination. You know, where you're having you're distinguished. Yes. Yeah.
But here, what he's talking about is simply like you hear a sound. Like there's no conceptuality attached. It's like a sense perception. And so appearances, he's just calling them, instead of appearances, like there's a sound, that's an appearance. It's like calling it a perception locates it more in a more like not outside space.
So there's just whatever perception or sound, whatever, it's an immediate feeling that somehow it's real and I have to pay attention to it.
Exactly. And that's where the conceptuality comes in.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to stop here. Anybody else have anything that they desperately wish to say, which is fine if you do. I don't mean to discourage anyone. Because I have a couple of things before we do our dedication. A couple of things. One is I sent out by email like the tentative schedule, which has us finishing up the end of June with like 1 week to play with. Somebody is muted. So hopefully we will stick that. It requires doing 4 verses in 1 week, which is doable because it's a particular thing and we're familiar with it and we don't have to go into depth. It just means I have to translate all 4 verses. So that will be whether we do it or not. The other thing I wanted to talk about is, but you can be thinking ahead. The point of this is you can be thinking ahead to what do we want to do next? We're going to have a hiatus of a couple of months. We can call it a break, or we can call it, as Mingyur Rinpoche does in his online courses, integration. see what happens to the 37 practices in 2 months when we're not studying it anymore. We'll call it integration months. So July and August, I'm going to be like not doing this class, and we'll all be on our own. But we can think in the meantime, and we'll talk about it at the end, like what do we want to do next? Do we want to keep going? I'd love to. I hope Lama Jinsung would like to. anyway, we can think about that. There's a lot of options. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about is, verses. So chanting the verses has become a bit cumbersome. Today we got all of the material in that I really wanted to get in because we didn't spend 15 minutes chanting the verses. However, hi Fanny. Some people really, really like chanting the verses all together. So I was going to offer for anybody who would like to chant all the verses together every week, I'm willing to be here at 12:45. And we could chant all the verses between 12:45 and 1 o'clock. And anybody who wants to come could come, and anybody who wants to come at 1 o'clock could come at 1 o'clock. So just let me know. I'm going to unmute everybody in a minute anyway after we do the dedication, and you can say, if I got like 3 people or more who would like to chant verses together, I'll be here at 12:45 next week. And if not, then chant them on your own. Like, we can do this at home, chant them, but it's not the same as chanting them together, I know, which is a very lovely thing. So what's the housekeeping things? So I'll ask about that at the end, but you can also email me. Like, I'd like to be there at 12:45, please, and we'll do it. So let's take a moment. I feel like I've been talking a lot and my brain's going a bit like, so let's take a moment to bring our minds back to rest, unless they're already there, in which case, wonderful. And we will, Joanne, Joanne, I'm gonna unmute you.
Hi, I just wanted to pass this book by you. Can you see it on the screen?
Hold it up toward the camera. It's at the top of the screen. Is that Ringu Tulku's book?
Yes,
very nice. It's a very nice book. He's a very concise, this is the 7 points of mind training.
Correct, and the one, I'm going to reread it, but the one, the second point was brought up with the Tonglen meditation. Mm-hmm. I guess it goes along with Lojong, and I'm trying to integrate it with 37 practices.
Yes.
Again, taking it off the cushion, so to speak.
Yes.
Interactions with not only my immediate family, but the human family when I do my volunteer work. And there again, I guess I'll carry it forth with our next conversation, Mama, as far as one mind meeting another.
Okay.
Part of taking and sending at the moment. And that is crucial. In other words, I'm in situations where I have to respect medical privacy. I don't know what the circumstances are, but I can see a need.
Mm-hmm.
some kind of support. And that's the anecdote for me at that moment in time.
Okay, thank you very much. And Rigby Tolkien's book on mind training is a very good explanation of the 7 points in mind training, which is, that was our previous study topic before 37 practices with the US study group. All right, thank you for that, Joanne. And now we will do our dedication. Again, bringing the mind to rest a little bit and remembering our motivation. Like, this is the culmination of our motivation for this today's class, is now we're going to share the benefit with all sentient beings. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, unto Zangpo and Hanji Shri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And just letting our minds come to rest one more time and connecting again, if we've been out of touch with it, with that feeling of vast, spacious, limitless mind that is the union of emptiness and luminosity, in which the experience is the experiencer. And now we are out of time. I'm going to unmute everybody. Everybody's unmuted.
Thank you so much.
Any thoughts on, we'll do it by email about meeting early. If anybody wants to.
I want to.
Okay, we got one. Okay. Okay, I'll send out an email and people
can. I'm going to try.
Okay. Well, all right, I'll be here at 12:45 next week. I'll send out an email, and those who wish to can get together and chant all the verses.
All right.
Thank you so much, Lama Jinzong, for being
here. Oh, why? Are you kidding? This is fabulous. I'm going to try to be here from now on.
That would be wonderful. We would so love that. Your comments are very valuable.
Oh, okay. I hope so. I hope I'm not like big mouth. So.
Okay. No, you're here as like, you know, we know you and we want you to be with us.
Okay.
And when do you go back to KTC?
Actually, I extended my stay to the 26th because my dad has a doctor's appointment next Monday that I want to be at. And the cheapest to fly, believe it or not, was on the Saturday of Memorial Day weekend itself.
Oh, my God.
I extended the stay. So I'll be here at my dad's for the next Thursday, but right. Then up north I'll continue.
Yes. Okay, wonderful. All righty. Well, thanks, everybody. And I will exercise my superpower and an energy for everybody.
Thank you, Lama.
Bye. Thank you, Namdok.
Bye, children.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you.